From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the architect of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell compromise on gays in the military, we talk with military sociologist Charles Moscos. Recently, he was in Somalia, where he says the racial mix of U.S. troops has helped to keep down violence between soldiers and Somalis. Moscos also advised the South African government and the ANC on how to integrate armed forces there. Also a talk with spy novelist John le Carré about writing in the post-Cold War era. His latest book is Night Manager. And Maureen Cargan tells us about the horror story that still scares her. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. The White House today offered its reaction to the shooting yesterday of a doctor at a Kansas abortion clinic, deploring the action. Dr. George Tiller was wounded in both arms last night as he entered his car outside the Wichita clinic where he works. Police arrested Rachel Shannon of Great Falls, Oregon, last night when she returned her rental car at the Oklahoma City airport. The National Organization for Women reacted to the Wichita shooting by calling on Attorney General Janet Reno and Congress to provide better protection for clinic workers. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Now President Patricia Ireland says her group has been telling the FBI for more than a decade that these acts of violence are not isolated or local. She says they're part of a nationwide campaign of violence aimed at clinic workers and should be treated with the same seriousness as other acts of domestic terrorism, such as the World Trade Center bombing.
If we have to continue providing the clinic defense, if we have to continue facing a Congress that's stalled and refuses to act, we will lose in 1993 by the bullet what we thought we had gained in 1992 by the ballot.
Ireland says the anti-abortion movement itself must accept some of the blame for yesterday's shooting. She says continued use of terms such as murderers and child killers to describe abortion providers will only lead to more violence. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Surgeons at Children's Hospital in Philadelphia today completed a five-and-a-half-hour operation to separate Siamese twins who shared a single heart. One of the infant girls survived. Dr. James O'Neill said Angela Lakeberg is comfortable and in stable but critical condition. Her sister Amy died during the operation. The leaders of Bosnia's three rival communities left the Geneva peace talks today with a draft peace plan they'll have to try to sell to their supporters back home. NPR's Sylvia Poggioli reports from Geneva.
The plan leaves the Muslims, the losers of Bosnia's 17-month-old conflict and its pre-war majority, with a landlocked area of about 30% of territory. They would be allowed road access to the River Sava in the north and to ports on the Adriatic. The Croats would be allocated about 17%, and the Serbs, who now control 70%, would get just over 50%. Bosnian Croats and Serbs voiced cautious support for the plan, but the Muslims said they were not satisfied, particularly because they get only two small enclaves in eastern Bosnia, an area which underwent one of the Serbs' most vicious campaigns of so-called ethnic cleansing. Mediators Lord Owen and Thorvald Stoltenberg conceded the plan was not sufficiently generous with the Muslims, but said they were unable to wring further concessions from the Serbs and Croats. This is Sylvia Poggioli in Geneva.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 3 points to close at 3615.48. That's a new record. This is NPR News. The massacre of up to 40 Yanomami Indians in a remote Amazon village this week is described by Brazil's Attorney General as genocide. And evidence has emerged that the government was warned a week before of the risk of conflict in the area. Jan Rusher reports from Sao Paulo.
Scores of police, doctors, and government officials, including the Minister of Justice, have now flown to the scene of the massacre, the remote village of Hoshimu, located in dense forest near Brazil's border with Venezuela. The Attorney General, who's also there, said the murders are a crime against humanity and would be treated as genocide. Police are now hunting the gold miners who killed up to 40 Indians. A survivor said that after shooting the men and hacking the women and children to death, the miners had celebrated. It's now emerged that a week before the massacre, a local Indian agency official sent a radio message to headquarters in Brasilia warning of the risk of conflict in the area. In spite of the warning, though, nothing had been done to protect the Indians.
Jan Rusher for the BBC. Court officials in California said today the California Supreme Court has rejected a last-minute bid by condemned murderer David Mason to appeal his conviction and postpone his execution next Tuesday. The court denied Mason's request for his case to be reopened because of what lawyers said was misconduct by his original defense team. Mason was to be executed in the gas chamber at San Quentin State Prison for the murder of four elderly people in Oakland and killing his cellmate. According to a poll released today, Californians give President Clinton a worse performance rating than any president in the last 30 years. The statewide poll by the Independent Field Institute found 27% thought Clinton was doing an excellent or good job, 37% thought his performance fair, 33% said it was poor or very poor. That's down sharply from February, when 50% said they expected Clinton to do an excellent or a good job. I'm Frank Stasio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. When Clinton ran for president, he promised to end the ban against homosexuals in the military. Once in office, he was forced to compromise and offered a solution which allows gays and lesbians to serve if they keep their sexual orientation a secret. This policy is called Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Don't Pursue. It didn't satisfy the gay rights community or the military, but appeared to break the impasse between the two sides. The man behind this new policy is military sociologist Charles Moskos. For the past 30 years, he has followed the U.S. Army to almost every war and conflict, where he has done exhaustive research on the culture of military life. He's known for his groundbreaking studies on race relations. He currently teaches at Northwestern University. Moskos is also the architect of President Clinton's National Service Program, which he says will give to civilian society some of the same civic values that the military provides for its members. We spoke earlier today about the new Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He said it will make life easier for homosexuals serving in the armed forces.
Well, remember, nobody's supposed to ask anybody a question about sexual orientation. If a gay person, however, wants to wear his or her sexuality on their sleeve, then they will be discharged from the service. That's where the compromise comes down. Remember, on the other side, you have to think, Marty, of the we don't mix men and women on a forcible basis on any kind of environment except perhaps concentration camps. We don't do that in jails. We don't do that in freshman dorms. We don't do that in the military. There's a somewhat of the parallel there is mixing people forcibly of different sexual orientations in an open fashion. The compromise prevents that, too, and it seeks to draw the analogy between men and women.
But does it prevent that? Because what the policy seems to say is that you can, if you're gay or lesbian, serve in the military. So how does that preserve the sexual privacy of heterosexuals?
Because people won't know it. That's how obviously there are gays and lesbians serving today and in the past. My own company commander, by the way, over 25 years ago was a gay. This has gone on historically in the military. It's never been a major problem because of the necessity for being very discreet about it. The compromise continues that discretion. Let me add one other thing, Marty. I think it's important here.
Go ahead.
You've been mentioning gays and lesbians. This is largely a male issue, though obviously it applies to both sexes. Our surveys conducted exhaustively among male and female soldiers showed us the male soldiers were most concerned and exercised over the gay ban. For women, if we had an all-female force, we wouldn't be having this conversation. Women are much less concerned. And I think it comes down to the gut reality that we males, you know, are the insecure sex, and therefore issues of heterosexuality, homosexuality are much more salient.
It's an interesting point you made, though. Does this policy reward male soldiers' insecurity or even reward their prejudices?
Well, you might say that if a woman doesn't want to shower forcibly with a male, and we say, by the way, we're not going to make you do that, does that reward her prejudices? Does that reward her insecurities? It's the same analogy applies.
Let me ask you something else, because part of the military code still stands, which is it still says that homosexuality is incompatible with military service. Does this new policy, though, somehow undermine that if gays and lesbians are being allowed to serve in the military?
Open gays and lesbians are not being allowed to serve. Gays and lesbians are being allowed to serve. Gays and lesbians, of course, were not allowed to serve in the previous regulation, you know, before January 1993. Any inclination or statement or insinuation of a homosexual sexual orientation was sufficient for discharge. This one now no more seeking will go on. Mm-hmm. And I guess the real issue is that it makes life for the serving gay much easier, while it doesn't really attend to the gay agenda in the larger society. But we're really focusing here on serving members, gay and straight. We don't want to forget the straights who also have rights. And that's why the compromise has come about.
Well, certainly members of the gay and lesbian community that have been critical of this new policy say that it really doesn't make their life that much easier because they still have to hide so much of their identity.
Absolutely, and that's the way it is. In the meantime, there'll be a lot of straights who are going to be uncomfortable with thinking that gays will be, you know, in their units sharing intimate living quarters. We're only hearing one side of the story here. Mm-hmm. Remember, there are two rights in collision here, and that's why a compromise was necessary.
Do you see this policy as a first step towards a more open policy at some future date?
Many of the conservatives fear that. I mean, there are many people who oppose this compromise for reasons that haven't been raised yet, and that's because on the right, there are people who see this as opening the door. This is the beginning of a slippery slope. Therefore, they really wanted to keep the old ban in effect. What makes our country unique, Marty, and that's why we're the only one that really faces it in the sense that of our discussion, we're the only nation in the world with a strong religious right and at the same time a very active gay advocacy community, which doesn't consist just of gays but also others, you know, who follow and sympathize with the gay equal rights movement. The fact that we have these two sort of polar opposites, both having political clout, both having media influence, means that we are unique in the world, and that's therefore we're the one who come up with a relatively unique compromise. By the way, no country in the world that we know of, speaking of advanced democracies in Europe or Israel, Canada, Australia, places of this sort, treat gays and straights exactly the same in the military. There's no country that does that.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I know that Senator Barney Frank had offered as a compromise was to say, let's divide behavior in half. Let's say that on the base that everyone has to abide by a strict code, but behavior off the base and out of uniform, gays and lesbians could live their gay and lesbian lifestyle. Do you think that would have worked as a compromise in the military?
Well, you know, Congressman Frank's, his version of don't ask, don't tell, as he stated himself, was because he realized the full lifting of the ban was not possible. He was attacked, I might add, by many gay advocates for compromising too quickly on the issue. De facto, we are going to be doing that. Off-base, discreet behavior is not going to be sought out or punished. Though, by the strict letter of the regulation, if somebody comes out or flaunts it, they will be discharged.
Right.
But de facto, we're going to have very much the situation Barney Frank envisioned.
Well, this new policy is being challenged in court. The ACLU has filed suit on issues of First Amendment and on Equal Protection Clause. How do you think this will get played out?
They'll be turned down. This is a very talking to gay advocate lawyers groups. They're very leery of that ACLU because they're going to get on very treacherous ground. Most likely, they'll lose. Courts have traditionally deferred to the military with regards to rights and responsibilities and free speech and the rest. That's not the area and the terrain to take this case to, and it may set up bad precedents which then can domino effect backwards, you know, into the civilian sphere. I think many anti-gay people are silently cheering the ACLU on into taking this in these treacherous waters. It's very ill-advised.
What?
If I were a gay person, I would be petrified by that action.
Explain a little bit more what you mean by that.
Because they'll lose, most likely, in trying to talk about free speech in the military environment, and that in turn could have bad precedents for civilian activity as well. This may boomerang. I would just let this alone. This has never been a major agenda, and you have to ask gay advocates to speak more precisely to this. Never been a major agenda. It became one inadvertently through the promise of the then-candidate Clinton, and then his early actions in the first weeks of his administration. It's really not the place to fight gay rights battles.
I'm curious if President Clinton had ordered that homosexuals be allowed to serve alongside heterosexuals as black Americans do today, what would have happened in the military?
What would have happened, of course, nothing, because Congress would have immediately passed a law codifying the ban. And then President Clinton would have had to either veto that bill or even have his veto overridden. Now, he could have gone down in flames and said, well, I did my best. I was overridden. Congress has now passed a law maintaining the ban. making a few points, but then nothing would have changed. Under the compromise, everybody's a little bit better off than they were before January 1993. This is a compromise with no winners or losers, but it seems that most people are agreed. And apparently, you know, public opinion surveys show large support for the don't ask, don't tell rule as well. So this is where the country is as well, and that's a very important factor.
Do you think there are any lessons that could be learned from integrating African Americans into the military that could be or have been applied to gays and lesbians? Do you see them as equivalent issues?
No, and this is usually an argument raised by white people. Most black Americans take a front at this. Survey data also show, for better or for worse, most black Americans are harder lined on gay issues than are white Americans. And I think their ultimate question is this. Sexuality, hetero or homo, is an essence of a person's identity. For people to use the race analogy then argues that race is the essence of somebody. Race is not the essence of a person's identity. Sexuality is certainly one, and there are other personality variables as well. And what we have to recognize here is that when blacks were integrated into the military in the early 1950s, it was done specifically to improve military efficiency. Had we had not an integrated military, and I've written extensively on this, we would not have an effective military today. We would not have a military which enjoys the legitimacy it does enjoy in the broader community. Nobody has seriously argued that opening up, for example, combat roles to women, which is another, you know, controversial issue, or allowing open homosexuals into the military is going to improve military performance. Rather, the arguments are made on civil rights grounds. The races were integrated not because we were nice guys, but because we had to do it simply to keep an effective military operating.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. My guest is Charles Moskos. He's a military sociologist, a professor of sociology at Northwestern University in Illinois, and chairman of the Inter-University Seminar on Armed Forces and Society. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is military sociologist Charles Moskos. Let me talk a little bit about President Clinton's relationship with the military. How would you describe it?
The president's relations with the military is not the greatest. It's somewhat tense. It's for a variety of reasons. One reason, of course, is, as we were discussing earlier in the program, the president's position on allowing open gays in the military. This was done without consultation with military people or looking at what service members might think about this question. Secondly, there's the president's problem with his own draft record during the Vietnam War, his avoidance of service, and the fact that he once wrote a letter to his ROTC commander at the University of Arkansas saying that he loathed the military. On top of that, you have a kind of feeling that the White House staff itself is not sympathetic or understanding of military personnel. And finally, and perhaps most important of all, because of the end of the Cold War, the military is going through a dramatic reduction in numbers and budget. Even a Ronald Reagan would have difficulties today making the kind of cutbacks that are necessary in a post-Cold War era. But when you put all those four things together, this is what accounts for the president's unique tensions as a commander-in-chief with the serving members of his armed forces.
Do you think the military is making some very basic changes, and it appears more and more that military leadership resists intervention? I'm thinking of places like Somalia, places like Bosnia, where it seems that military brass is putting the brakes on any kind of U.S. intervention there.
Historically, contrary to, you know, popular and conventional thinking, the military has always been much less hawkish than civilian leaders. This goes back to Korea. It goes back to Vietnam. The military knows that its own people are going to be killed in these kinds of situations. The Somali intervention is an interesting one. I was there in late February and early March. At that time, it looked like we were doing a decent job, although the military was reluctant in the first place. But events since that time, when that Somali operation fell under United Nations control, has really gotten out of hand. Where we were there formerly on a humanitarian mission, we now seem to be on a mission of chasing down warlords and actually shooting Somalis, for which I can find no rationale. And in a sense, you might say the military may have been justified in its earlier caution. Of course, that was under President Bush, and then continued by then-elected President Clinton.
Well, I know that you talked to soldiers in Somalia about what their life was like, what conditions were like for them there. What did they tell you?
The soldiers going to Somalia believed that they were going there for a humanitarian mission, and most were quite upbeat about it. This was also for Black American soldiers, male and female, a major point in their life because they were, in a sense, symbolically returning to an African homeland that they'd never seen but had heard much about. I might add, just parenthetically here, the percentage of women soldiers on the American force in Somalia is double that of what it was in the Gulf. About 12% of our, at the time I was there, were female, compared to only 6% female during the Gulf War. Yet we've heard very little bit about women soldiers in Somalia because there have been no problems. I mean, the big story is there is no story. Now, what was interesting about Somalia was we had 24,000 American military personnel in that country on the 1st of March. We had killed two people in excessive force. These were Somali youth who had stolen things from Americans and gotten shot by American soldiers and killed. We don't even know how many people were killed by the Nigerians, the Botswanans, the Moroccans, the Pakistanis. We know the Canadians, with only 800, killed four in excessive force. The Italians killed 12. These were much smaller contingents than the Americans. And the question arises, why did the Americans have such a low rate of violence toward the local Somalis?
What's your answer?
And I think the answer is that we were the only multiracial army there. The monochromatic armies, if I can make up such a word, I mean, the all-white armies like the Belgians, the French, the Italians, or the brown armies like the Pakistanis and the Moroccans, or the black armies like the Botswanans and the Nigerians, were much more violent toward the locals than the Americans. And I think we were the only country suitable for that role because black and white soldiers had more experience on multiracial issues, kept an eye on each other, and generally were well-behaved. Our soldiers certainly were unhappy at Somali incursions, petty thievery, taunting that was continuously going on, but they maintained a high level of discipline, which is the mark of a true professional soldier. I was quite proud of those men and women, and I'm quite disappointed to see that American forces are involved in shooting Somalis in a United Nations operation. I'm a skeptic of the UN. I mean,
I can hear that. I can hear that. I want to shift gears and talk about South Africa, and I know you just returned from South Africa, where you were working with the Defense Ministry and the ANC on integrating the armed forces there. Who invited you?
I was invited by the United States Information Service and the Institute for Defense Policy of South Africa to consult with the African National Congress, ANC, which is the Nelson Mandela political party, and the South African Defense Force, which is the existing. The issues were several and very interesting in South Africa. They were interested because of my work in racial relations in the American Army and wanted to know what lessons, if any, might be drawn for South Africa in a post-apartheid era. As most of us know, in April 1994, there'll be elections, and presumably, though this can't be foretold with exact certainty, Nelson Mandela will be the next president of South Africa.
You're predicting that?
Well, most South Africans are, but it's not a done deal. What you have to think here is you have a South African Defense Force currently, which is technically proficient, but does not enjoy the legitimacy, of the black population. Indeed, it's viewed as an enemy in most cases. Though at the lower ranks, it's about half black, but its officer corps, it does have some minorities into the so-called colored of Cape Town area, the Indians who are descended from Indians from India. But it's basically a white officered military.
So
how do you bring in blacks and the guerrilla army of the ANC into it is the issue of the day. I think it can be done. And I'm, as I tell everybody, nervously optimistic that this can be pulled off.
Well, what were some of your suggestions to them about how to integrate then the upper levels of the defense force in South Africa?
Yeah. The upper levels, let's say generals and above, there have to be some lateral entry from the ANC side. Some of their senior military people will have to simply be placed in some senior jobs there as generals. The lower levels will be relatively easy because you can just bring in second lieutenants and young lieutenants, black as well as white, and in the natural course of events, they'll be trained and work their way up the system. The lower enlisted ranks, again, won't be much of a problem, except you'll find the end of conscription which presently exists in South Africa for whites only, will mean that the South African lower ranks will become heavily black in the not-too-distant future. The real problem that arises in South African military is how to integrate the middle levels, which in American terminology would be something like majors and colonels, because these people are not going to be getting out shortly as the senior people will. They're not working their way up through the system as the junior people will be doing. That's where the tough decisions will be made. And one way of handling this, of course, is that the South African white officer corps sees itself as technically proficient military professionals and view the what's called the MK, that's the military arm of the ANC, as just being political types. On the other hand, the MK view the South African officers as not having any credibility in the larger society, taking part in nefarious operations, not being very professional when it comes down to behaving properly in townships and in violence directed against blacks. The way of handling that, and it's not easy, obviously, but many of these black future middle-level officers can get professional training, I think, overseas, including America. Mm. But many are already going to places like India. Many had went to former communist countries like East Germany and Russia were notable. But they can go to India, the United States, the United Kingdom, places of this sort, get military training if they don't trust the South African Defense Force that currently exists. And these then can be integrated, I think, into a system of a fairly equal treatment. I might add, when I said I was nervously optimistic, I found some remarkable amounts of goodwill on both the white and on the black side. And with a little give and take, I think this thing can be integrated. And then you'll have a military which will be racially integrated, and like America, might be the only other military suitable for peacekeeping roles in a multiracial context.
How, and I know that you've looked at racial issues in the U.S. military, how analogous would you say U.S. military or U.S. race relations are to South Africa race relations?
Well, there's two big differences, and then there's one similarity. One big difference is that we integrated a minority into a majority institution. Blacks, of course, make up only 11 to 12% of our population. So that was one, while blacks make up 70-plus percent of the population of South Africa. The second is that our American military, by and large, enjoys the legitimacy of the people it serves, including the black community as well as the white community. This is not true of the South African Defense Force, which does not enjoy credibility with the vast majority of that country's population. So those are two big differences. The similarity, though, is that our American military integrated not because it was trying to do the morally correct thing, but because it simply had to do it. It was a necessity to have an effective military which would enjoy legitimacy in the larger society and perform better. That's the same in South Africa. Its military is going to have to integrate if it wants to enjoy the credibility and legitimacy of the broad sector of that community and at the same time remain technically proficient. Now, there are going to be extremist groups on the left and on the right, extreme rightists on the white side, extreme leftists on the black side, who just won't be able to live with that situation. And hopefully that this new racially integrated middle-of-the-road and politically legitimate military system will be able to outride these kind of extremists on the left and on the right.
Well, we covered a lot of territory, and I thank you for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure, Marty.
Charles Moskos is a military sociologist and teaches at Northwestern University. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. We'll be right back.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoen with Fresh Air. Coming up, writing spy novels in the post-Cold War era. Spy novelist John le Carré says he was ready for a change anyway. His latest novel is about the fallout from the Cold War, the clandestine world of international arms dealing. And Maureen Cargan tells us about the horror story that haunts her still after 20 years. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Doctors in Philadelphia say that 7-week-old Angela Lakeberg is now in stable condition after an operation to separate her from her Siamese twin. During the long operation, the twin, Amy, died. Vicki Quay of member station WHYY reports.
Chief Surgeon Dr. James O'Neill says it's too early to predict what Angela Lakeberg's chances are, but it's encouraging to have come this far. O'Neill and his 17-member operating team knew this morning that Amy Lakeberg would have to be sacrificed to give Angela, the stronger of the twins, a chance at life.
It's a deeply personal, difficult experience, but you go through such experiences because you have the desire to help people, and they want you to do that.
The twins were born in suburban Chicago, joined at the chest, sharing a liver and a 6-chamber heart. The family's doctors recommended against the operation, saying neither was likely to survive. Parents Joey and Kenneth Lakeberg say it's a miracle Angela made it through the surgery. For National Public Radio, I'm Vicki Quay in Philadelphia.
In New York City at the UN, Yugoslavia's Minister of External Economic Relations has called for the lifting of international economic sanctions against his country. However, there are no indications that the UN Security Council is prepared to act on his request. NPR's Trevor Rowe has more on the story.
Ankovic's visit to the UN is part of a stepped-up campaign by Yugoslavia to have sanctions lifted or at least eased. The sanctions were first imposed in order to force Serbia to press the Bosnian Serbs to comply with the Vance-Owen peace plan. However, since the plan is now widely regarded as dead, the Yugoslavs argue sanctions should be lifted. They say their economy is a shambles, with inflation running at over 1,000% a month. While at the UN, Unkovic met with Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali and U.S. Ambassador Madeleine Albright, who is this month's president of the Security Council. A U.S. official said afterwards that Unkovic was told that, as of now, there are no grounds for lifting sanctions. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
U.S. troops are now taking part in U.N. peacekeeping efforts along the border between Macedonia and Serbia. There are more than 300 U.S. soldiers in the U.N. operation that is an effort to keep the war in the Balkans from spreading. The troops were sent to the border region to serve as a warning to military factions in the southern part of Serbia against pushing further and across the border. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 3 points today to close at 3,615.48, a new high, on volume of more than 275 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by only a small margin in heavy trading. This is NPR News. In Geneva, Serbian and Croatian factions have agreed to a compromise peace plan, but Muslim leaders have indicated that they may turn it down. All sides have 10 days to consider the plan. The agreement combines conflicting ideas of Bosnia's 3 warring factions to divide the former Bosnia into 3 states. UN spokesman said the deadline for accepting the plan is the 30th of this month, and in his words, if they don't sign, then the war will continue. In nearly 1.5 years of fighting, up to 200,000 people are dead or missing. The peace plan reportedly gives Muslim factions about 31% of the land, with Serbian factions getting 52% and Croatians about 17%. Serbian and Croatian forces now control about 90% of Bosnia. In South Africa, a caller to the news media has said that a black guerrilla group was responsible for last night's rocket attack on an oil depot. One empty storage tank was hit, but there were no injuries. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Johannesburg.
The caller told the South African Press Association that last night's attack in the town of East London was intended as a warning to Western governments to stay out of South Africa's affairs. The caller said the assault was carried out by Cambodian-trained members of the Azanian People's Liberation Army, the armed wing of the Pan-Africanist Congress. In May, the government arrested dozens of PAC members in what it described as a crackdown on the Congress and its guerrilla wing. Most of those detained were later released with no charges. Little is known about the current size or operations of the Azanian People's Liberation Army, which has claimed responsibility for several attacks on white civilians in recent months. I'm Ann Cooper in Johannesburg.
In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against the Japanese yen, but fell against other major foreign currencies. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. For many years and for many novels, John le Carré wrote about intrigue and espionage under the rules of the Cold War. The ongoing hostility between the Soviet Union and the West was the backdrop for his early novels, including the one that made him famous in 1963, The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, as well as some of his later books, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and Smiley's People. Le Carré doesn't depend entirely on his imagination to write about spooks. He had some related experience. Le Carré spent 5 years in the British Foreign Service, where he was known by his real name, David Cornwell. He was instructed to take a pen name when he started to write espionage fiction. His new novel, The Night Manager, takes place during the Persian Gulf War. It involves the international arms trade and drug dealing, and pits a former military intelligence operative named Jonathan Pine against Richard Onslow Roper, a ruthless British arms merchant. John le Carré told me that it was the excesses of capitalism that got him writing this new book.
I mean that during the 80s, when we were very greedy and when we had materialism and affluence instead of morality, if you will, it was still possible to justify the amount we paid ourselves and the amount we ate and the amount we wasted in the context of the economic war with communism. Now that war is over, and the excuse, the justification for self-indulgence, if you will, blind self-indulgence, limitless expansion, that excuse has been removed, and we have to address the consequences of capitalism. And so that's what I'm trying to do in this case. I think that my main character is a creature of excess who seems to have inherited his decadence, and a person of absolutely no personal morality, and he's taking and taking and taking and wrecking the world in the process, and people.
One of your characters says, arms are a drug.
Yes, I believe that. He goes on to say, don't believe any of this nonsense you hear about willing seller, willing buyer. It's just another industry. Good heavens, you can go back to your wives and children in the evening, and you're just like other people. I have spent quite some time now particularly with the illegals, the arms dealers who don't officially work to any government pattern. And I've spent a fair amount of time with others who make arms. I think that it is about male macho. It is that feeling that you have entered some other new state of power and almost something supernatural about people who play. The feeling that some people get from playing with guns. I think it's a great problem, loving guns. It's a great problem when you address the hideous situation that we have now worldwide, with all the detritus of the Cold War lying around, huge, great stockpiles of arms just waiting to be used again. It's a great problem that, as we see it from outside, the United States is so tolerant of arms control or no control at home that it really has no credibility as a world policeman in this field.
The other part of this novel deals with narcotics trafficking, and I wonder if there isn't a similar and also different kind of ambivalence about that. One of your characters, and this is actually a Treasury man, says, why are we so squeamish about drugs anyway? Service industry, willing buyer, willing seller, vast profits to the third world. Some of it's going to go to the right places. Must be. We accept tobacco, booze, pollution, pox. Why are we such prudes about drugs? Does he reflect at all any of your thinking?
Well, what I did realize when I got into the drug stuff, I've done it twice. I explored the heroin traffic up in the Shan States in Southeast Asia, north of Burma, when I was writing a book called The Honorable Schoolboy, and then I went back to it for this book, and that was the cocaine scene. The Drug Enforcement Agency tells me that the United States still spends more money on cocaine than it does on food. And the black economy, the scale of it, is absolutely extraordinary. What I discovered was that in third world jargon, cocaine is to some extent the punishment which the gringos deserve. That the coca plant was something that was given to them, as it were, by God. It belonged to their culture for a long time. They chewed the stuff or they did whatever they did with it. And they enjoyed it and they kept it within bounds. And it was we, the white West, if you will, we decadent people, who developed these excessive tastes and put such a premium on the thing and thus altered the economy of Central American and South American states to a great extent. So they see themselves as having a kind of moral position in purveying it, many of them. That's the self-justification. It's much more complicated from their point of view than it is from ours.
Let me get you to read a section from your new novel, The Night Manager, and this is really a description of Jonathan Price.
Jonathan Pine.
Excuse me, Jonathan Pine.
Here he is. He was a compact man, but tentative, with a smile of apologetic self-protection. Even his Englishness was a well-kept secret. He was nimble and in his prime of life. If you were a sailor, you might have spotted him for another, recognized the deliberate economy of his movements, the caged placing of the feet, one hand always for the boat. He had trim, curled hair and a pugilist's thick brow. The pallor of his eyes caught you by surprise. You expected more challenge from him, heavier shadows. And this mildness of manner within a fighter's frame gave him a troubling intensity. You would never, during your stay in the hotel, confuse him with anybody else, not with Herr Stripley, the creamy-haired front-of-house manager, not with one of Herr Meister's superior young Germans who strode through the place like gods on their way to stardom somewhere else. As a hotelier, Jonathan was complete. You did not wonder who his parents were, or whether he listened to music, or kept a wife and children, or a dog. His gaze, as he watched the door, was steady as a marksman's. He wore a carnation. At night, he always did.
That's John le Carré reading from The Night Manager, his new novel. Do you fashion your characters on people that you've known? Is that something even that you consciously do?
Yeah, people I know, people I look at. I think when a novel starts forming in your head, and the characters particularly start standing out and wanting to be described and counted and formed, I find myself greatly stimulated by any casual thing I see in the street or round a dinner table or the odd word that I hear, and I keep battered notebooks and rush off to the men's room and scribble down my stuff. And then I get all these little bits and notions, and he would make this gesture, he would have that kind of voice, this cadence, this accent, these mannerisms. And then I start putting them together, but what really makes them sit up and work, of course, is the moment where you can breathe something of your own nature into them so that one is really playing, as I like to say, with the possibilities of one's own character.
Well, I want to talk some more, but first we have to take a short break. And my guest today is John le Carré, and he's written a new novel called The Night Manager. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with novelist John le Carré, and his new book is called The Night Manager.
You worked for the British Secret Service. Did that help you as a writer? And you were just mentioning how...
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I mean, the ability, I guess, to... I don't know how much cloak and dagger stuff you did, but the ability to impersonate or to become another person.
Well, I was never as clandestine or as dramatically engaged as that. I think that I was always a writer who became a spook for a while, rather than a spook who became a writer. I once, Graham Greene was also in the Secret Service. There's a kind of tradition about it in Britain. I don't know why. But I asked Graham whether he'd enjoyed it, and he said he had a very slight, rough, sort of royal R. And he said, no, anyway, I was frightful at it. Were you? And I said, yes, I think I really was. And he said every time he sat down to write a report, he really wanted to write what it might have been like. He wanted to juice it up because all the boring banalities, the information that he'd gathered, were quite insufficient to his writing nature.
So you found it boring as well? Is that why you weren't good at it?
No, I think it's why I wrote. I found it insufficient, but I think that, you know, I went through a lot of institutional lives. I was a schoolmaster. I taught at Eton for a while. I've done other kinds of government work that weren't spookery. And none of it was satisfying to me. And no uncreative life would ever have satisfied me.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your father.
Uh-huh.
And he was a con man.
Mm-hmm.
Your novel of Perfect Spy was based on your father.
Yes.
Have you come to see him, or did you see him even as a young man or a child as a kind of double agent because of the fact that he was a con man?
Well, being a child, I was much more self-centered, so I saw myself as a double agent because he was a con man. He was a sort of multiple agent. You never knew where he was going to pop up next. I mean, when you wanted him to zig, he zagged. And those guys, they're like actors who write their own lines and parts. I mean, he would see a scam, and he would dress for it and make his pitch and secure his collaborators, investors, victims, and he would live a whole existence until the deal fell apart or he made rather grubby money. The effect of this life upon ourselves as children, I think, was that we had to compose characters that were resilient enough to the vicissitudes of that life. And we also had, as creatures of his ambition, he was enormously ambitious and enormously loving towards his children in his own way, we had to pretend that we were the children of the man he was pretending to be. So he was saying, I'm this rich tycoon, I'm this generous man, I support charities, I do this and that. And we would echo all this stuff and look like dear, sweet, well-educated, well-parented, middle-class kids going off to school in press grey suits and going through the private education stuff when he could afford to pay the fees, or somebody else could. And meanwhile, we knew we had undefended backs. We knew that where we came from was chaos. And so conformity, integration with society, became almost a visceral need. It's something that sprang from a childhood appetite to find recognition in the collective because there was no recognition back at home. I mean, no recognizable form for one's life back at home.
What was your father's charm? Because it seemed that he, even to the very end, was able to get away with all sorts of scams. And it must have been something that he exuded to be able to do that.
Yeah, he was terribly good. He was a great student of human weakness, having most of the weaknesses himself and being instinctively a communicator and a joiner and a palsy kind of man. He was very quick to detect people's appetites and weaknesses and things. And if he had a sense of their sexuality, he would try to supply that in some way through introductions, bring on the dancing girls and whatnot. If he felt that what they really needed was here, you know, with their wives, a little holiday somewhere, he would arrange it. He was marvelous at the gifting side of it all, at the obtaining of people, at putting stuff into the favors bank and calling on those favors at crucial moments. And he could also bully.
And yet you said you felt he loved you in his own way. Could you trust that kind of love from that kind of father?
No. Absolutely not, and nor could you reciprocate it.
So that was, I guess, an ongoing issue?
Yes, until I wrote the book about it. But I don't think, I mean, you have in the States, you have some very good books on the subject. There's The Duke of Deception by Wolfe. That's right, Geoffrey Wolfe.
Right. I think.
Which very much records my own experience. And indeed, when my elder brother read that book, he said, I'm not going to bother to write about Father. This guy's done it wonderfully. You don't forgive. You don't forget. And you find it terribly hard to produce the love you feel you ought to feel for that parent. That was a real obstruction when I was writing A Perfect Spy. And it wasn't until I was able to make the son even more awful than the father that I got away from the whinging tone and the self-pitying and got it straight. But as to love, it doesn't... I don't think time makes it any easier. I'm afraid the older I get, the more fascinated I become by my childhood, which I think actually is common to many people.
Well, I don't want to get too Freudian here with you, but do you think a lot of your books have really been in some way about your father, or about the duplicitousness of him?
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And I often think that my relationship with Smiley is a relationship with an idealized father figure. Hmm. You know, Smiley was always much older than I am. He had a lot of social clumsiness, which I feel I have, and yet at the same time saw a lot, functioned well, got by. And and then the obsession with untruth, with duplicity, with fork-tongued behavior, that flowed naturally through my experience of my father and then into the secret world.
John le Carré's new novel is called The Night Manager. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about the news today. Noah, what stories will you be covering on All Things Considered?
Hi, Marty. The state of Michigan has decided to do away with local property taxes to fund the public schools. Michigan will now try to find $6 billion every year to help pay for the school system. There's been a shooting at an abortion clinic in Kansas. A doctor was wounded. He's said to be back on the job today. NPR's Dan Charles investigates the privacy issues involved in the sending and receiving of electronic mail. Sue Downey reports from Phnom Penh on an offensive against the Khmer Rouge guerrillas. Also, Bob Mondello reviews the new, unusual Western, The Ballad of Little Joe.
Noah, thanks. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Most horror stories take place on a dark and stormy night in the dead of winter or during the melancholy season of fall. But there's one turn-of-the-century horror story that describes the evil peculiar to a summer's day. When the heat is so intense, it can scramble your brain. Critic Maureen Carrigan offers a timely appreciation of William Fryer Harvey's horrific short story, August Heat.
I first stumbled upon W.F. Harvey's short story, August Heat, nearly 20 years ago in a collection of supernatural tales. Harvey is an overlooked master of the psychological horror story. You may know his most famous tale, The Beast with Five Fingers, which was made into a silly movie starring Peter Lorre. To understand why August Heat has haunted me for so long, you need to know a strange fact about my childhood. My father, for most of his working life, was a heating and refrigeration mechanic. He could take apart air conditioners and put them back together again blindfolded. But oddly enough, ours was the only apartment in the building without an air conditioner. Every summer, my mother and I would plead for one. My dad could get air conditioners wholesale, for heaven's sake. And always he would refuse. His reason? Air conditioners reminded him of work. To this day, he and my mother roast in that very same apartment. And when I visit in the summer, Harvey's story haunts my troubled sleep and my waking dreams. The power of August Heat comes mostly from its curious style. It's written as a diary entry by an artist named James Clarence Withencroft on the evening of August 20th, 1900. Withencroft has had the most remarkable day in his life. The morning dawned hot as hell, and Withencroft planned to spend the day at the local swimming hole. But suddenly, inspiration strikes, and he sketches for hours as if possessed. By afternoon, Withencroft has finished a bizarre picture of an enormously fat man, a murderer, standing in the dock just after a judge has pronounced sentence. Withencroft goes for a walk to clear his head. He walks for miles until he reaches a stonemason's cottage. In the yard, a man is cutting an inscription on a tombstone. He's a huge man with sweat pouring from his scalp. He's the man in Withencroft's sketch. Withencroft looks at the tombstone. It reads, "Sacred to the memory of James Clarence Withencroft. Born January 18th, 1860, he passed away very suddenly on August 20th, 1900." The stonemason, a Mr. Atkinson, claims the inscription was a sudden inspiration. Withencroft shows him his sketch. They ponder the eerie coincidence. Atkinson then persuades Withencroft to stay put until midnight in order to ensure that no accident befalls him on the journey home. Bad idea. But Withencroft agrees. Here's the final paragraph of August Heat. "The air seems charged with thunder. I am writing this at a shaky table before the open window. The leg is cracked, and Atkinson, who seems a handy man with his tools, is going to mend it as soon as he has finished putting an edge on his chisel. It is after 11 now. I shall be gone in less than an hour. But the heat is stifling. It is enough to send a man mad." An air conditioner would have made all the difference.
You can find the story August Heat in the Air reprint edition of W.F. Harvey's first short story collection, Midnight House, or you can hunt through some old horror anthologies. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Ron Barron, Richard Parker, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, and Audrey Vablaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowain.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a Depression-era saga of a scrappy 12-year-old boy's misadventures in a flophouse. It's a new movie by the director of Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and it's based on the memoirs of writer A.E. Hotchner. I'll talk with Hotchner about his childhood and about his friendship with Ernest Hemingway. I'm Marty Moskowain, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.